This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup.
I do quite a lot of collections of sort of David Hicks by Ashley Hicks fabrics and carpets and stuff. Quite a lot of them are things that I sneak in, which are sort of in his manner, but actually would slightly annoy him. Things that he wouldn't quite approve. And then I do my own thing, which would really drive him nuts.
Hello and welcome to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to people at the top of the creative industries whose names have been inextricably linked to luxury. Today, my guest is the designer Ashley Hicks. He followed in the footsteps of his father, David Hicks, perhaps one of the most charismatic British interior designers ever. But unlike him, he doesn't just create distinctive and arresting interiors, but also actually makes some of the beautiful pieces that furnish them. He's become a very successful fabric designer and furniture maker. And if that wasn't enough, he's published numerous books about his father's work, and most recently one about the stunning interiors of Buckingham Palace. Ashley, these podcasts, I'm sure it's been explained to you, but we're looking at aspects of luxury in people's lives. And that's quite ironic when dealing with you, because obviously you were born into a degree of luxury that many of us may never experience in our lives. At what point were you aware that you were surrounded by luxury?
Gosh, that makes me sound terribly spoiled. I suppose I probably was. My older sister, Edwina, and I realised that there was something a bit different going on when we kept saying to our mum, you know, can we go in a bus? We want to go in a bus, because the whole time we were stuck in the Rolls Royce with the sofa, and we saw these big red buses going by and they looked such fun. And Peter Guttridge, who was our Rolls Royce chauffeur, whose real name was Percy, but my father decided at the interview that Percy wouldn't work, and so he called him Peter. And my mother, bless her, never discovered until about a week ago when I broke the news to her that his real name was Percy. She'd never realised. But anyway, Peter used to be a bus driver. So he drove my parents mad by always giving way to the bus, which wasn't the thing to do in the 70s, you know. But anyway, so we go, obviously, in the Rolls, you know, with the nanny, and we sit in the back of the Rolls and we go to a bus stop. And so when the bus is about to arrive, we get out of the Rolls Royce. In order to be tactful, you know, we get out and the Rolls Royce drives up the road a bit. And so then we stand there and then the bus arrives. And so we get on it with everybody else and we pay our sixpence or whatever it was. So exciting. We sit on the top and we can see the
view. Total Enid Blyton adventure.
It's so much better than the Rolls, yeah, because you can really see the view from the top. Unfortunately, halfway to the next stop, the bus breaks down. And so everybody is told to get off the bus. And so everybody does get off the bus. And because we're on the top, of course, we have to file past the whole queue of people who have already got off the bus to the Rolls Royce, where Peter Guttridge is holding open the door for us to get in. It was a little embarrassing.
And were there any sort of catcalls, whistles?
No,
or anyone trying to climb in the back with you?
Imagine, yes. God, I mean, imagine today, but obviously in those days, everybody just sort of watches. And
you do have this sort of impossibly grand and slightly offbeat background. You know, Prince Philip is your godfather, Earl Mountbatten was your grandfather, and your grandmother, Edwina, well, she's a sort of whole library of books all in one life, isn't she?
So, well, yes, but I also had two sets of grandparents.
Yes, so, but of course, we being the media, focus on one.
Well, I know, and you can imagine my father also focused on the one that you've just mentioned, but he did quite often talk about his own parents, who were, you know, Bertie Hicks, who was a rather failed stockbroker from Essex, whose own father had been born in 1816.
And so had he sort of broken away from his roots? I mean, had he sort of stepped beyond his supposed societal limitations when he married?
Oh, yeah. God, yes. Absolutely. No, his father was a failed stockbroker from Essex. And his mother was slightly, you know, a successful stockbroker's daughter. You know, and they had quite a few servants inside the house. But then, you know, sort of most people then.
But not the Rolls waiting by the bus.
But no Rolls waiting by the bus, exactly. So it was a combination.
So did you feel that you had choices growing up, or that you were very much established in this grand tradition and needed to carry it on in some...
I think we felt slightly sort of confused, obviously, because obviously our poor papa felt very confused, you know, and that he'd always felt since he was a child that he was extremely special. He used it, you know, when he was about four, he invited Queen Victoria to tea. And Queen Victoria, of course, had been dead for many years. And his mother was completely, you know, not disconcerted by this. And there was a great deal of opening the door for the Queen and baking a special cake for the Queen and pretending she was sitting there. And my father literally, you know, that was his life.
So what she completely enabled his grand dreams.
Totally.
And so she was probably the last person who was surprised at him marrying up, as it were.
Oh, I mean, and totally uninterested. Totally uninterested. I mean, it's so unimpressed by the royal family, it just wasn't true, you know. She thought they were quite nice. They were fine. You know, what was so special about it?
And
she couldn't understand his endless stories about, you know, oh, we went to stay with the King of Norway, you know, I forgot my dressing gown. You know, and she was totally uninterested, you know, except, of course, forgetting the dressing gown. That did seem silly.
You are described as an interior designer, but I wondered how much you see yourself as an interior designer. Because I imagine, you know, there's an awful lot of sort of pandering that has to go on as an interior designer, isn't there, to sort of difficult clients and oligarchs and so on.
If you work for clients a lot, and especially if you work for people like oligarchs, which I don't, if I do work for people, then I normally do it for sort of friends or friends of friends or people who have, quite often they've got their own stuff. So I don't have to take them shopping on the Pimlico Road and go back the next day and collect my 10% in an envelope or whatever it is that people do, which obviously isn't very good for business, but it's a lot nicer for the soul, I think. But I spend a lot of time designing things, products, you know, fabrics and carpets and furniture and all that kind of thing. And then I also do, I'm not really an artist, but I make little funny little totem sculptures. And so I sell quite a lot of those.
Why do you think you're not an artist?
Well, because they're not actually art, they're decorative objects, let's say. So in the tradition of sort of 18th century decorative objects, you know what I mean? There's sort of, you know, Blue John vases with ormolu handles and...
Yes, but I think perhaps you do yourself an injustice by saying you're not an artist because, you know, in many ways, many of the things you do require artistry.
Oh, sure, yes. But then again, you know, to be an artist, you know, I went to art school for 4 years, and the one thing that will do to you is make you not want to claim to be an artist afterwards if you're not, you know.
And was that before or after you studied to be an architect?
Before.
So you really did decide not to be an artist?
I did.
Why?
I did. I think probably total lack of confidence, I think.
Was it an act of revolt to go to art school, or was that very much something
that was... Yes, probably a bit, yes. My dad was very keen that I should be an architect and be his architect partner. You see, he'd do it the inside, I'd do the outside, and I'd get the doors in the right place. Because obviously decorators always think the architect has got the doors in the wrong place.
So you'd be his sort of accomplice, his side man.
Yeah.
Then you came round to that way of thinking.
I sort of did temporarily. We worked together for about 6 months. Not a huge success. He had an assistant, thank God. You know, his business had gone bust. And so he'd sort of started again on his own in a very small way. So he had an assistant, luckily, who bore the brunt of the, you know, the various rages and you know, difficulties. And one morning I got a taste of the assistant's life when he dialed the wrong phone number, you see, and I pick up the telephone and there's my father, you know, what the fucking hell have you done now, incompetent bloody antipodean idiot? And so I say, Dad, actually it's me. It's not your Australian assistant.
So what were you thinking when you decided to become an architect? What was that motivated by?
I think really just, you know, having left art school, got to London, having done some fairly odd paintings at art school with sort of self-portraits of my brain exploding and that kind of thing, very odd. All of those I was stored in my father's office on Jermyn Street behind his showroom, and somebody from BBC or something went to interview him. And I had put the pictures in his private office facing the wall so that he wouldn't be upset by these hideous pictures. And he, of course, had turned them all round. And he was quite proud. You know, he probably thought they were quite good. And the interviewer, of course, looked at the pictures and said, you know, who did those? He said, my son. Is he all right? Which my father thought was hilarious.
He became a decorator and he became... I mean, we're talking about him like everyone knows who he is, but probably people don't.
No,
literally.
For other design, you know, designers, young designers, more or less all of them are obsessed with him.
Yes.
They've all got his books.
So describe to me, if I say David Hicks, it's in the style of David Hicks, what am I saying?
Well, you see, that's part of the secret of his appeal, is that it could actually mean a whole lot of different things. And so people say it's unmistakably David Hicks, and in fact, it is unmistakable, but, you know, that might refer to a slightly minimalist-looking all-white room with, you know, very, very simple, very natural-looking furniture. Or it might be, you know, a crazy sort of kaleidoscope of, you know, purples and reds and pinks, you know, clashing colours and then combined with, you know, rather wild antique furniture and modern pictures and...
So was he a chameleon?
There's a whole range of
influenced
things.
By the people he was working
for?
No,
he had quite a strong style, but his main aim in his work was to get as many photographs and as much publicity out of the work as possible.
Really? So
what
he was a 21st century man.
He was, but a ruthless one. So he wasn't remotely interested in earning money. Absolutely no interest at all. His only interest was in earning page space in magazines and filling up the endless books that he published of his own work.
And what did he want the fame for?
I think just for the sake of it. You know, he grew up in slightly straitened circumstances in rural Essex, would bunk off school to go to the pictures and just watch those Hollywood movie stars tapping their cigarettes on their cigarette cases and blowing smoke out, you know, and he just thought they looked so glamorous and he wanted to be one of them. And then obviously saw the royal family constantly in the papers, thought that looked wonderful, so he wanted that. And the only way he could get it was by, you know, becoming a decorator and doing what he could, you know. And his life's work consists of his 25 volumes of scrapbooks stuffed with press cuttings.
Which you edited.
Which I did. I edited them and published them, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the scrapbooks, because obviously you paint your father as this very much larger-than-life character, but very few of us have the opportunity to sit down and witness a parent's life in the minutiae that you were able to encounter, because he kept everything.
He did keep everything, but he had, you know, his scrapbooks, it was just press cuttings. Pull out from magazines and newspaper articles.
And the occasional,
you know, if you had a telegram from royalty, then obviously that would go in, or a royal Christmas card.
Wasn't there also people who sort of declined dinner invitations so long as they were grand enough to
be
of note?
Oh, yes, no, there's an entire page collage of invitations and cards and things about the opening of his Paris shop in 1973. Very chic, because in 1973 he had the opening of a London shop at 11 a.m. and the opening of the Paris shop at 11 p.m., isn't that good? But in the centre of this collage is a postcard from Grace of Monaco, you know, Grace Kelly, saying, you know, dear David, so sorry, can't come. Which, I mean, anybody else would have probably tied it away somewhere, but no, you know, it's from Grace Kelly.
She
couldn't come, but...
But she's there.
Yes.
And she replied.
Yes.
That's what counts.
Yes.
Because what's interesting about that is the fact that when you describe him, I imagine that if I was his child, I might have wanted to put as much distance between us as I possibly could, and yet you've done the opposite.
Well, yes.
Despite your early break for the border by going to art college, which actually he'd sort of toyed with anyway. Aside from that, it seems that your career, very successful as it is, has been a long process of sort of joining paths with his.
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, very much diverging. You know, I do quite a lot of collections of sort of David Hicks by Ashley Hicks fabrics and carpets and stuff. Some are his archive designs, which I adapt and recolor and rescale. And then quite a lot of them are things that I sneak in, which are sort of in his manner, but actually would slightly annoy him, things that he wouldn't quite approve. And then I do my own thing, which would really drive him nuts, especially because he'd actually quite like it, possibly. But it's against everything he stood for. So, you know, my rooms in Albany, which used to be his rooms in Albany in London, you know, he had decorated in a very sort of simple, graphic, bold way, typical of him, with sort of chocolate brown walls, completely simple, and just white plaster reliefs on the walls and all male portraits from the 18th century. And so I stripped all that out and stuck Hessian all over the walls and painted sort of murals of a view of the Bosphorus in 1818 with the Greek muses, statues, posed under Ivy Bowers. What are you laughing about?
I'm laughing at the non-minimalist aspect to this absolutely redecoration.
Non-minimalist. And he, you know, he thought that any sort of wall painting scheme done after 1939 was just anathema. You know, I mean, nobody should ever have painted a mural after that date. So his stomach would have churned at the thought of it.
Is there a sort of an act of revenge being played out?
Oh, yeah, a little bit, of course. Of course. And it's full of women, you see. He had a big thing when he redecorated after, you know, when Allegra and I
decorated our first
married home, and it was in magazines, and he was frightfully jealous, and so he redecorated Albany as a response and got rid of all of the female portraits. And so he said Albany is a place for men, and so there were only male portraits, and then a portrait bust of Lord Palmerston sitting on the chimney piece, only men. And so I, you know, got rid of all the men and put only women in the form of the ancient Greek muses.
So how have you managed to create your own identity in the, you know, perpetual shadow of this gargantuan ego?
Well, you know, I mean, I also had a gargantuan ego and perpetual shadow from my grandfather also. And so, you know, the two of them, it is rather a lot. I suppose with difficulty. But I've, you know, I mean, the nice thing about it is that I'm not, you know, by any means an early peaker, rather as he was, you know, because his best work was all done in his 30s, really. And by the time he got into his 40s, it was going downhill. Whereas I keep developing and doing new things, and you know, life's rather exciting.
And so when, I mean, you make all kinds of things, as you or design all kinds of things, you know, from wallpaper to carpet.
Well,
to,
and make. I do a lot of things with
pieces,
my own hands.
Yes.
Which he would never do. He'd think that was frightfully common. And the most idiotic idea, sort of craftsmanship. I mean, nobody, you know, like somebody sort of tinkering away in their shed in the country, you know, which is actually what I do. You know, I've got a shed in the country and I carve pine wood into console table bases that look a bit like coral and then gild them myself, you know. But he would have thought, it's a ridiculous idea, you know, you should do a sketch, you know, or you get a photograph of some nice old thing and you get somebody to copy it.
But I'm struggling to understand your relationship with him, because on the one hand, it feels like an enormous burden that you've had to carry with you from a tiny age, because he was so large.
Yes.
You know, I mean, not obviously physically, but... And on the other hand, it sounds like you have an enormous kind of...
Affection
and connection with him. I mean, you've never divorced from him.
No.
Have you?
Well, you can't divorce your parents. Well, you can, I suppose, but no, not when they're dead, you know.
No,
he's
but
been
you...
dead for 20 years. You know, it wasn't quite as easy before he was dead, I suppose. But it was quite easy sometimes, you know. We got on pretty well. Yeah.
But you have stayed immersed in... I'm just trying to figure how much is Ashley Hicks' world of design and how much is David Hicks' world of design.
Yeah, they're very separate. They are very, very separate. I mean, you know, a lot of things, you know, my little sculpture things, he would loathe, I should think. I'd hope.
Well, you'd hope.
I wouldn't hope. I don't know. You know, it's also a generational thing. You know, someone who started working in the 50s obviously loathed everything that was happening in the 50s. I love everything that was happening in the 50s, you know, because it's long before my birth. So, you know, your prejudices are pretty much dictated by your generation.
So if he was after fame, what is it that satisfies you? Is it the actual tactile experience of making the table, or is it...
Yes, I love, you know, I'm so obsessed that I photograph all my own work and my own rooms and everything. And I've got a book coming out in the fall, in fact, that I've photographed entirely myself, my own work, and then historical sort of inspirations for it. But I love, you know, having the image of the room, the image of the work, but I don't particularly care how many people see it. I'm not really interested in, you know...
And does it feel like a departure that you have this book coming out in the autumn that is about you?
I know, right? I mean, yes, who'd have thought? Well, I've got all these historical things in there too.
Yes, I know, but still, you've got something that says... And if
I know, because I'm endlessly doing books about him, which is just ridiculous, you know. But, I mean, he was a raging narcissist, so it's, you know...
He'd be grateful,
What else can a narcissist undo, you know?
So this book that's about your style.
Yeah.
I've asked you how to describe your father, and you said that was very difficult because it could be one thing one moment and another another. What's yours? How would you describe it?
Heavens.
Your style?
Well, sort of eclectic, I suppose. You know, it's a mixture of sort of historic influences and a lot of hand-painted walls, which might be sort of trompe l'oeil schemes like the one I was describing, or just sort of graphic patterns, a lot of handmade bits of furniture and strange and interesting objects that, you know, are easy to live with, but look slightly curious. You're not quite sure where they're from, what the origin is. I find that interesting. I'm not interested in reproducing historic things or in, you know, making very simple modern looking things. I find that terribly boring.
So are you interested in the connection between the past and the present?
Yes.
But with a twist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when you're describing the murals and things, I'm suddenly drifting off and thinking Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, and I know that's not...
God! Good God, no. He came, Lawrence came to interview me about my dad in the rooms in Albany before I'd redecorated them. And he turned up on his cufflinks. He said, do you think your father would have liked my cufflinks? And they were gold penises. Large gold penis cufflinks. I said, I didn't really think my father would have liked your cufflinks, Lawrence. No. Not remotely.
And when you do create a home, whether it's yours or for someone else, how much do you think it's influenced by the sort of grandeur that you've existed amongst? Because, you know, as I said at the beginning, this being a podcast about luxury, I'm wondering what you consider to be luxurious, whether it is as obvious as, you know, fabulous gilding or, you know, incredibly luxurious drapes or whether there's something similar.
No, I think I consider, you know, I mean, in the matter of drapes, you know, the vital thing is tailoring and making them absolutely, really as small as possible. As small as possible, you know. But I mean, the exact right length, you know, you have curtains puddling on the floor. Disastrous. You've got great big swags of fabric. And it's oppressive, isn't it? You know. Anyway, let's...
interested. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah. No. I'm very kind of scientific in decorating. Furniture has to be proportioned right for the room. And there's a lot of decorators who are like, oh, it's all about scale. You want an enormous piece to dominate the room. Of course you don't. It's just going to make you feel like you're in, you know, you're a little tiny Lilliputian or something. It's going to be horrible. You know, you want things that are going to make the room feel harmonious and make you feel comfortable, you know, spiritually. You also do need furniture that's going to make you comfortable from a comfort point of view, you know, which my father was absolutely against. You know, rooms should never really be comfortable. I mean, they should be comfortable, but so long as people are going to sit very upright in an upright chair and, you know, in an elegant way and who know how to sit on a chair. You know, if anyone ever sat on one of his 18th century chairs and leant back perilously on the two back legs, he'd be, I mean, absolutely livid, throw them out of the house.
I'm,
you know,
so
you,
glad
you would
I
break
never,
the chair.
So glad I never had that encounter because I'm the world's worst sitter. I mean, I
you're
just
sitting
have to
beautifully.
Be, no. I have to, like, feet up and,
sprawl.
You know.
Sprawl. No, well, I like sprawling, you see, so I always have huge, comfy sofas, but, you know, beautifully tailored. So.
Beautifully tailored.
Beautifully tailored.
And to scale.
And what I do for clients, always, you know, the few clients that I have, you know, I make them make their big living room into a doubling as a cinema. So instead of having, like, you know, the separate media room, which obviously what people want to have, it's so idiotic. So then you don't actually use the main living room. It's like used, what, three times a year for the big party. Whereas what's nice is to be able to live in that room because it's going to be the most beautiful room in the house. You're going to put all the work into it. So I always have a cinema screen in there somewhere, like hidden in a sculpture on the wall or hidden in some bookcases or something. So then the entire family can all gather in there on weekends and watch movies.
But it sounds like your style has been to bring practicality back into grandiosity.
Well, a bit, I suppose, yes. I don't think I'm very into grandiosity, to be honest.
No, that's what I'm saying.
You've
brought practicality. I mean, we're talking about large rooms with televisions hidden in sculptures. That's not everyone's
front room. Sure,
just
yes.
You know, just before we drift off into, you know.
That's true. We are at Harrods.
your father doesn't sound like someone who worked particularly well, you know, with other people in collaboration. Is that something that he's passed on to you or not? I mean, you collaborated a lot with your first wife.
Yes, we did. He was very good at delegating, very good at having an office full of people working for him and people carrying stuff out and, you know, being rather sort of, you know, rather dictatorial with them. Whereas I'm afraid I'm absolutely hopeless at that. So I don't employ anyone. I work completely alone. You know, I have two employees, in fact, one who drives a van and assembles bits of furniture and things like that. And the other one is actually fictitious.
I don't think you should be saying that. HMRC might be listening.
Oh, do you think? No, he isn't paid by the company or anything, you know. He just writes fictitious emails, you know. So you've got to have an assistant, haven't you? But I can't cope with a real assistant, so I have Francis Grills.
But now you've revealed it to the world, you're going to have
I'm not sure the world will hear this.
Oh, don't be surprised.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
everywhere.
I would be very careful about the confessions that you make here.
It's not a confession.
It's a whole new world out there, isn't
Francis
it? I mean, you know that.
Francis once got into a quite chatty relationship with Tom Ford's assistant. And so there was backwards and forwards, you know, and Tom's assistant was called Rhiannon. But there was a whole backwards and forwards between Rhiannon and Francis. Until one day, then it was Rhiannon said, well, you know, Mr. Ford would like to come to the studio and look at the samples. So, you know, would Thursday work? At which point Francis had to be, oh, no, you don't understand, the studio is actually in Oxfordshire and I'm there, so sadly we'll never meet, you know.
Are you sure that Rhiannon actually existed? Or do you think there's a whole world of fictitious assistants?
Elizabeth Saltzman told me all about Rhiannon, who was actually a very pretty girl, apparently. So Francis rather regretted it at that point. I mean, not that he exists, of course.
Are you a perfectionist?
Somebody else, occasionally Francis fucks things up, you know, and when he does, then, of course, you know, I have to step in and say, I'm so sorry, Francis says, I've just discovered what he's done. It's awful. And once I told somebody, you know, don't worry, he's out in the yard being whipped.
And how long?
Picture of poor Francis being
whipped. How long has Francis, this poor beleaguered assistant, worked for you?
Oh, at least 20 years. At least 20 years. Yeah. Now, I used to tell my daughters that it was the office Christmas lunch and Francis and I were going out for sushi.
So that was just you alone moving a piece of salmon back and forth across your plate. So sad.
Very
so
nice.
So how would you describe what does Ashley Hicks mean as a business? As I'm a business person. I want to buy into Ashley Hicks. What am I buying into?
Heavens, I don't know. I don't know. Style, design, I suppose. The trouble with me really is that I'm a jack of all trades. You know, and this is where my father would despair, the idea that, you know, I didn't really specialise properly. So, I write books, I photograph things. You know, I've just done a book on the interiors of Buckingham Palace, which, you know, most of them not been photographed properly before.
Do you think that people would be disappointed that go into... people with real taste would be disappointed that go to Buckingham Palace at some of the rooms? I went to one that had a lot of pink in it, a lot. It was a very big room.
Yes.
I don't know which room it was.
The picture gallery.
Yeah, they had a
very
reception.
Very long.
Yes.
With pink flock wallpaper.
Yes.
Rather a mistake. It was quite a beautiful sort of crazy Victorian room with a very complicated white domed ceiling by Nash. And it was rather wonderful. And unfortunately, King George, Queen Mary did not like it. And so in 1913, they had it removed and replaced by Mr. Frank Baines of the Board of Works, who was a disaster and really completely buggered up the whole room. Rather terrible.
Tell me about your 16-year-old bedroom that you designed, your first design job, I think. Perhaps.
My first design job, sort of, yes. Now, we moved house because my father had basically spent most of my mother's fortune decorating the old house, and so we had to sell it and move to a much smaller house. And so us three children were given the choice of either Daddy designs your room or you do it yourself. And so my sisters, who knew which, you know, way their bread was buttered, obviously had Daddy design their room. And I was like, I'll do mine. And so mine was completely black. So it had black walls, black ceiling, and a black sort of velvety carpet, and then white furniture. And the white furniture all seemed to sort of float in this kind of inky sort of void. It was rather wonderful, actually. It was a bit odd in Oxfordshire, you know. And then there was a large circular window with a view of green countryside, which is the only colour you could see.
How long did you keep it like that? It sounds quite amazing, actually. I think I'd quite...
Well, you know, it was a teenage bedroom in a, you know, in the country, so obviously I went off to art school and that kind of thing, so I wasn't really there that much.
What would be your ultimate job? What would be, you know, that's it. That's it. I can retire now. I've done my best, my everything.
I'm terribly selfish. I really only like doing things for myself. Is that a terrible thing to say? No, I mean, what I would love to do, actually, is a hotel bar. Do you know that bar in the St. Regis in New York?
Yes.
You know, with those murals. I'd love to do something like that. Wouldn't that be fun?
But yeah. But that culture of sort of going to a grand hotel and sitting in the bar and having your drink there, I'm not sure that we've got that to the same level.
Not so much. But then we you know, invite people into our own homes here, which obviously people don't do in New York except for possibly once a year for a charitable event.
We've established that you have lived in the lap of luxury at numerous times in your life, if not always. But I've also asked you to bring along something that defines luxury for you. So tell me what you've brought.
Yes, well, I brought this rather tatty-looking old book. It's looking very beaten up, unfortunately. And it is volume 3 of Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son. And this is, as you can imagine, a relic of my father. Lord Chesterfield, you know, had an illegitimate son who I think he recognised, but because he'd come from the wrong side of the sheets or whatever, he felt that he needed to instruct him in how to be a gent.
How old is this book? Because I'm looking at it and it looks very, very old indeed. It's quite
watermarked. 1806, this one. 1806. Letters written by the late Right Honourable Philip Dormer Stanhope, Earl of Chesterfield, to his son, Philip Stanhope Esquire, late envoy extraordinary to the court of Dresden, together with several other pieces on various subjects. But it's hilarious.
And absolutely why is wonderful. It your luxury? Why do you feel this connection with it?
I just, you know, I love old things. I love the language of these letters. I love the fact that it's just so completely bonkers, really, you know, read today. It's full of sort of the most eccentric bits of advice.
Give me a bit of advice.
Really not very helpful.
It's quite a battered copy while you're looking. You could describe the jacket because it's not...
Well, it's not a jacket. It's a leather. It's a gilt-tulle leather binding, Morocco binding, but it's all worn out and the cardboard's showing through and it's in a terrible state. Here's letter 233, London, November 8th, old style. 1750. My dear friend, which is how he addresses his son, before you get to Paris, where you will soon be left to your own discretion, if you have any, it is necessary that we should understand one another thoroughly, which is the most probable way of preventing disputes. Money, the cause of much mischief in the world, is the cause of most quarrels between fathers and sons. The former commonly thinking that they cannot give too little, and the latter that they cannot have enough, both equally in the wrong. Marvellous.
Do you actually sit and read it?
Or no, never. Never. It sits on, you know, there are four of them and they sit on my bookshelf. My father used to read them, you see, and you know, he'd telephone me rather drunk in the evening. And I'm such a boring person, you know, that I'd never have anything to say to him. So he would get out his appointment diary and read to me his appointments for the coming weeks, which I'd already heard them, you know, the previous week. And he'd burble on about it. And then I'm having lunch with the Duke of Abercorn, you know. And then if he ran out of appointments to read me, then he'd reach for Lord Chesterfield's letters and read me some of this.
So that's why it's your luxury. Yeah. That's quite a heartfelt, a romantic
story. It's rather fun, isn't it?
Being completely serious for
but
a
I
moment.
But I also, you know, I loathe the idea of luxury, you know, and the idea of luxury being something brand new, you know, that you unwrap and it's been newly made, but expensively crafted, and it's from some luxury brand who've spent, you know, most of their money on advertising so that you've, you know, become desirous of owning the thing, you know, and then you show it to your friends to make them jealous. I mean, all of that I find absolute anathema. I hate that. To have a luxury thing that is, you know, something old, inherited, and rather fascinating, historical, but not really valuable, you know, it is all tatty.
Have you inherited lots of amazing things?
Not that many, no. No, because my mum is still alive and so she's surrounded by amazing things. But when she moved out of the rooms in Albany where I, I'm living, you know, all the her beautiful antique furniture and everything that my father had decorated around in there, she gave it all to India, my sister, saying, poor India, she doesn't have anything. Whereupon it was empty. And so, of course, I was thrilled. Because, I mean, much as I loved all that antique furniture, it was all very beautiful, you know, I do like making my own things. And so I was able to make absolutely everything from scratch.
Is it like a showroom for you, or would that be way too vulgar?
No, it wouldn't be vulgar. And yes, in a way, it is totally a showroom. You know, I now have a gallery in New York who are representing my, you know, furniture and design pieces. And the guy from there, who's called Zesty. Isn't that a good name? That is his name,
certainly,
Zesty.
Certainly
I think his real name
things.
Is something else, but, you know, he calls himself Zesty. And so he came to Albany, you know, and he was blown away, I think he said, you know, by the sort of total environment. And that's why he wanted to represent me, Zesty.
Do you think that you're uncomfortable with the fact that you actually do feel quite passionately about designing and making things?
No, I feel very comfortable about it.
Why? I think that you, because I think you're quite disingenuous about it. I think that you sort of shrug it off.
As though well, that's just, you know.
As though it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, that's just, you know, I really don't like being too precious about things. And I have a great sort of fear of sounding, you know, I suppose possibly like my father. he was rather keen on what my mother calls blowing your own trumpet. Which, of course, my father would say, well, who else is going to blow it?
Just finally, we would unleash you on Harrods and you could go anywhere and take anything. What would it be?
Gosh, that's rather exciting. See, yeah. I'd like to get them.
Oh, I love these photographs.
I'd like to get them. All that wonderful Rococo plasterwork in the hat shop. Doesn't that look marvellous?
Ashley's talking about a photograph on the wall. Have you seen the one outside, which is in the shoe department?
Yes.
Same era.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Yeah. They're really beautiful photographs. Okay, so we're going to allow you to take the photographs from the wall. Okay.
Oh, good. Yes, that's what I'd like. I'd like the photographs, big blown-up photographs of the old interiors.
Thank you very much, Ashley Hicks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Ashley Hicks. This podcast was recorded in Harrods in London.